Welcome to episode 126 of Breakout Culture. I'm Charlotte Metcalf. I'm the associate editor at Country and Townhouse.
And I'm Ed Vasey, the culture editor at Country and Townhouse. And we're delighted that today's podcast is brought to you with the support from Lomi, the makers of a very clever smart waste appliance that transforms food waste into plant food and is compact and good-looking enough to sit on your countertop.
Yes, now Lomi is especially good for people who don't have very regular bin collections, as it does away with all that smelly food waste that can stink your kitchen out. So we're very keen on it. Plus, as it's helping save the planet by transforming waste into plant food, it's very in tune with Country and Townhouse's B Corp credentials. But now let's turn to our guest today, who's talking to us from Edinburgh.
Yes, Sir John Layton was curator of 19th century paintings at London's National Gallery for over 10 years. And from 1997, he was director of the Van Gogh Museum until he was appointed director general of the National Galleries of Scotland in 2006, a post he is stepping down from next February. But he's been knighted. He was knighted in 2012. And he's also achieved his ambition to construct the new Scottish galleries at the National Galleries, and they're going to open at the end of September. Welcome to the podcast, Sir John.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Ed. Good morning, Charlotte.
Well, good morning, and it's very good to have you with us at such an exciting time for Scottish art, as the creation of the new galleries cost £38.62 million and was one of the most complex engineering projects ever undertaken in a heritage building in Scotland. Huge congratulations. Thank you for being with us at such an important moment. So can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about what they can expect from the new galleries?
Of course. Let's start with a little bit about the setting and the architecture. Maybe a good place to start is why we've created these new galleries. Perhaps I could evoke for you what a visit to the galleries would have been like just a few years ago. If you'd walked along Prince's Street, Edinburgh's main thoroughfare with the castle there, and stepped into the galleries through these imposing columns, a sacred temple of art, if you like, you would have enjoyed a series of masterpieces by Western European artists from Raphael, Titian, Poussin, Rembrandt, through to the Impressionists. But you might have asked yourself, is there any Scottish art here? And if you were particularly observant, you might have spotted a little corridor at the back and gone down some narrow stairs into what we used to call the B Wing. And there would have been a cramped display, rather crowded, rather dingy, in fact, of our collections of Scottish art. And most people, one in five people who made it down there, actually just turned around and left. It was so uninspiring. So we were frequently criticised for having what you might call the good stuff on the main floor and the Scottish stuff in the basement. So it was high time to do something about that. So what we've effectively done is flip it around. We've now put the main entrance on the gardens level. We've remodeled all that. We've upgraded the facilities. We've re-landscaped the gardens outside to make it accessible for people in wheelchairs or with prams and so on. And you now enter through the main entrance and go straight into a wonderful new display of what we call the world's greatest collection of Scottish art. 150 years of Scottish art from around about 1800 through to 1945. So no longer this feeling that Scottish art is somehow hidden away or that we're embarrassed about it. We're now doing justice to that collection and showing it proudly in the context of the international art.
You've got some fantastically famous paintings, haven't you, that are instantly recognisable. I mean, where were they before? Where was, you know, Lantier's Monarch of the Glen, for example, or the skating minister, which everybody knows? Were they in this dingy corridor?
They were actually on we would have thought of as the main level. But it's really about doing justice to that collection and giving it space to breathe. So the new galleries have a contemporary feel. There are windows along the side, a new facade with views out over the Prince's Street Gardens and the spectacular Edinburgh skyline. So you can look at 19th century views of Edinburgh, paintings of Edinburgh, and then do a half turn and see the view for itself. It's quite spectacular. But part of this is about making the whole place feel more accessible, that people outside can see in and people inside can see out. It feels more porous, if you like, away from that closed, I mentioned a sacred temple feeling, which a lot of people find quite off-putting, imposing, if you like. So this is meant to be a space which, yes, still feels special, but isn't intimidating.
I've got a lot of sympathy with that view that, the sort of neoclassical facade of the National Galleries can be quite imposing and off-putting to people who aren't used to galleries. But doesn't the new entrance, isn't it slightly disorientating? Because obviously that's not how the building was originally designed to begin with.
It's a complex set of buildings that we have right in the centre of Edinburgh. If you have effectively two large neoclassical buildings, there's the Royal Scottish Academy, which we at the National Galleries, we look after, and which is our home for special exhibitions. Then there's the National Gallery building itself behind it. And underneath, there's a linking modern area. And then there's this area for the Scottish collections that we're discussing now. So a complex set of levels. And so what we've done is we've completely rethought the circulation. So for the first time, you can follow logical routes, different choices, but logical routes through all those buildings and end up where you started instead of going down dead ends or confusing routes. So we think it's clearer. We think it's more intuitive. And hopefully the public will too. We'll find out from the 30th of September.
And why was it such a complex project?
Part of it is based on a wing that was added beneath the 19th century building in the 1970s. And that is situated above the main Glasgow to Edinburgh railway line, so above three railway tunnels. It's beneath the Grade A listed building and within the constraints of a World Heritage site. So there were plenty of challenges, but all of those, I'm glad to say, have been successfully overcome. And I couldn't be more pleased with the result.
Well, I've seen the plans and the model, if you like, just online, and it does look absolutely fabulous and open and, as you say, very, very contemporary and airy and light. So tell us now a bit about the artists. There's 130 works, is that right?
One of the things that our research has shown is that levels of awareness of Scottish art are really pretty low. And when we asked audiences, who do you know, who are you familiar with, the answers that tended to come back were Charles Rennie Mackintosh, who of course was essentially an architect, the Scottish colourists, and maybe the Glasgow Boys. So that's one of the reasons why we've extended the displays for the first time into the 20th century. We take the story up to 1945 so that we can show works by the early moderns. It also, I think, makes the whole display a bit more accessible. There's colour, there's a subject matter that is immediately engaging, less classical mythology and so on and so forth, more everyday life. But I think people will discover artists that, or rediscover artists that are perhaps not household names, but deserve much greater attention. I'm thinking, for example, of Phoebe Anna Traquair, the Irish-born artist who made her career across various media, but was primarily known here as a mural painter. But there are some stunning embroideries and pictures by her, which show Celtic revival themes, but absolutely intricate and very, very engaging. Perhaps also another stunning highlight, I think, are the seascapes by William McTaggart. A whole room full of beautiful land and seascapes from southwest Scotland, where he began as a figure painter, but as his career develops, the figures become less important and the landscapes and seascapes start to dominate until you get to this late work, which I think is worthy of comparison to a Whistler or a Monet. It's absolutely beautiful. You can almost smell the sea and the seaweed in it. It's a great piece of painting. So highlights by familiar artists, but lots of less familiar names to discover as well.
And you've also produced a whole load of very good short videos. You know, I saw a couple, a really good one about the mysterious garden, for example. Margaret MacDonald McIntosh.
Everybody tends to think that Charles Rennie McIntosh was almost like a solitary genius who appears out of nowhere onto the scene in Glasgow. But in truth, of course, he was part of a much wider context, and that included the MacDonald sisters, Margaret and Frances. And Margaret produced some amazing watercolours as an example in the display. Charles Rennie McIntosh said, later in life, he said, I have talent, but you have genius, to Margaret. It's a haunting piece, I think inspired by a play by Maeterlinck, a very mysterious subject, full of those sinuous, elegant forms that you associate with the Glasgow School, and nothing explained, but very intriguing.
Tell us a bit about Scottish contemporary artists.
One of the, I think, great features of the galleries in Edinburgh and the National Galleries is that it is one organisation, but it's spread across different sites. So at our Portrait Gallery, you can follow the origins, if you like, of painting in Scotland, particularly in portraiture, and from the 16th and 17th century onwards, and take that story through to the present day. Over at the Galleries of Modern Art, we show 20th century and contemporary Scottish art. And perhaps somewhat bolder in the exhibition policy and the programming there than we would be at the National Gallery in the Centre, which we tend to think of as being more, I don't know, classic with a twist, if you like. So while all this is going on with, if you like, this golden period of the 19th and early 20th century at the National, we progress with a whole series of exhibitions and conversations with the collection over at the Gallery of Modern Art at the moment. For example, there's a fantastic exhibition of the Scots Barbadian artist Alberta Whittle, who explores themes from the colonial past with very up-to-date and sometimes quite provocative subjects from Scotland's present, such as the trial of the inquiry into what happened to Sheikh Ubayu, who was killed in a police incident some years back. But she does it with real empathy and without making viewers wanting to wear a hair shirt. It's a really moving and interesting approach. So we can do that over in the west of the city while showing Landseer's Monarch of the Glen in the centre, which I think is part of the strength of the whole institution.
Has it allowed you to develop a narrative of Scottish art that wasn't there before? I mean, I'm thinking about the Tate Britain rehang. When you rehang a gallery, you can often draw out a different or new narrative and perspective. Has it allowed you to do that for Scottish art?
That's a very good question. I think first of all, I should explain that in the new galleries, there is a chronological framework, a loose chronological framework, because that offers an important scaffolding for people. But within that, all the galleries and spaces are arranged in themes. So you'll perhaps begin with a set of galleries around romance and reality in the early 19th century, where you follow how artists are starting to discover the Highlands and the Scottish landscape as a source of inspiration. You have the influence of Walter Scott, the whole idea of the land of mountains, rivers and flood and so on and so forth. And so there'll be an exploration of literary influences and the making of, I suppose, the modern tourist image of Scotland, Landseer's Monarch of the Glen. There'll be themes around the Celtic revival. There'll be themes around the Glasgow boys, modernism. So we try to produce these individual displays that are coherent while moving through a broad narrative. And your question, what would be the overall linking narratives through all of that? One, I think, very much is that discovery of the land and townscape of Scotland as a source of inspiration. I think another would be what you might describe as a search for identity, maybe personal, maybe national. Are there distinctive qualities to Scottishness that artists are starting to explore? Because although this is an international story, artists from Scotland going out to London, going out to Paris, spending time in Germany or America and bringing ideas back, it is, of course, an exploration of, well, what does it mean to be
in Scotland? What does it mean to be Scottish throughout that period? And maybe a third linking narrative would be about a fascination with the making of art and artists who are growing sophistication, if you like, of their techniques, their approach to materials. Is that particular to Scotland? Well, there's something about the proximity of the academy and the art college, which I think brings out that whole idea of, if you like, the nuts and bolts of creating art, which is one of the themes that we've tried to bring out.
You would have had to tread quite delicately, I suspect, because any narrative of Scottish art is inevitably political, given the political kind of climate in Scotland.
I think my answer to that would be, I think the most fervent nationalist will find much to be comforted by in these displays, but so will the most active unionist. Artists of all political views are represented in these displays. So I think depending on your point of view, you will find something to latch onto. But you're right. There is, and I said it earlier, there is a question about identity and what is particularly distinctive about Scottish art that might make it, that separates it out perhaps from British art. And there's no easy answer to that because, of course, artists move backwards and forwards and don't respect borders and don't necessarily respect political boundaries. But I think that tension is one of the reasons why the displays are in fact so fascinating.
Well, I think it's the most interesting conversation. So I'm just thinking about one of the most famous contemporary artists painting at the moment, who is officially kind of Scottish, who is Peter Doig. Of course, do you consider him to be a Scottish artist or probably not? I mean, what do you think?
Depends who's asking, Charlotte.
I was thinking about Peter Doig as well.
It's really interesting, isn't it? I know. I was just it's such an interesting conversation because he doesn't really. Has he done any Scottish paintings? I don't know.
Well, it is an interesting question. We take a very broad view of what you describe as Scottish. So it's really art and artists that in some way are closely associated with this part of the world. So Peter Doig was born in Edinburgh and spent, I think, the first 3 years of his life here before he moved on. And we did a great exhibition with Peter, was it 2014? At the time, his father was here and living in Edinburgh. And I talked to him about this, and he was in no way, if you like, rejecting the idea that Scotland has had an influence on his art. Even though you had these wonderful sort of Caribbean seductive Gauguin-like colours hanging in sometimes dreich situation of Edinburgh, it kind of worked. And he loved the spaces. He loved doing the show here. He's recently engineered a painting to come into our collection, which we're delighted with. So, yeah, it's an association. Is he a Scottish artist? Well, yes, by birth.
Tell us about your other projects, because you've got a plan for a collection storage facility as well.
So, yeah, that's really the basic first task of any museum, isn't it? To look after the collection and secure it. And like so many institutions, our collection has grown and grown. I was slightly alarmed to look up this statistic that in the time that I've been here, there have been something close to 22,000 objects added to the collection, which is something like a 20% growth rate in the time that I've been Director General. I think my successor will have to do something about that. So we've outgrown existing storage facilities. But what we want to do with this new complex is something a bit different. We want it to be sited in North Edinburgh, in one of the most deprived areas of the country. We want the facility to be as open, as inclusive as possible, to be adopted by the local community. And we want to use it as a hub to be part of a wider regeneration project in that area, but also a hub to really get that collection on the move, locally, nationally, and internationally. We own, together with Tate, we own the Artist Rooms collection, for example, which is tours around the country. It's a really important project for us to secure, but also to be able to exploit the collections fully as we go forward in the years to come.
We've been working with the community down there for years now, knowing what they want. And one of the things they want is a safe social space, somewhere where they can actually just go and be part of a wider community which isn't a shopping center or which isn't a commercial area. So this facility has been very much designed not just around the collection needs, but around the community needs, which I think is really important.
It's very exciting. It's very like similar to what the V&A is doing in London with its amazing new storehouse. And again, setting it in quite a deprived area.
We've followed the development of all that very, very closely. We're just a little bit jealous of the budgets, that's all.
So, of course, the next question is, having achieved so much, Sir John, what are you going off to do in February?
Well, I thought I might become a tattoo artist, actually, which...
It's funny. It's funny you say that, because I'm obsessed by getting tattoos. I'm going to start with my first one on my 56th birthday next June.
It was actually a suggestion of my daughter who said that it would combine my two my greatest interest, which is art, with my greatest fear, which is needles. So she thought that this would be a brilliant next step for my career. But the serious answer, Charlotte, to your question is that I trained as an artist at the art school here, and then went into art history. So I thought I'll go back to where my career bifurcated and see if I can retrace the steps and go down the art route. I don't think Peter Doig has anything to be worried about, but I'll give it a go.
I'm sure we'll find you hanging in the National Galleries of Scotland in the next few years.
Yeah, whether you'll find the art hanging there, Ed, is another matter. But...
Well, very good luck with it. It opens on, the new rooms open on the 30th of September. Is that right, Sir John?
30th of September, yeah, just days away.
Obviously, the king is dead, long live the king. Who can step into your shoes?
Oh, that's one thing I'm not involved in. So we'll see how that goes. And yeah, 17 and a half years is a long time to be the head of something. So I'm hoping they'll find someone with... they'll certainly find somebody younger, somebody with a lot of energy, and there are great opportunities. It's a fantastic job.
Are you the longest serving director?
No, not even close. It's quite interesting going around the displays of the Scottish art, actually. I see several of my predecessors on the walls there. There's an artist called Cursiter, who was director of the Gallery of Modern Art. Another one called William Fettes Douglas, who does these amazing paintings. And you think, how did they have the time? I suppose they didn't have to sit in audit and risk committee meetings or sit around with sponsor teams at government or whatever. But no, Timothy Clifford, my predecessor, was...
Oh, of course,
was
yes.
Well over 20 years. I can't remember exactly, maybe 24 years.
I wonder what it is about the institution that keeps you there for so long.
This is such a great place to work, and such an amazing city, great collections, great audiences, and fantastic staff. So, yeah, who would go anywhere else?
And as well as your legacy of the new galleries, you've also massively increased the visitor numbers, haven't you?
Well, it's a bit disingenuous to claim that, isn't it? So which museum and gallery hasn't increased its numbers in recent years? So... yeah, that's the kind of thing you shove into a press release, but I don't feel personally responsible for that. What I think we have tried to do is keep a real sense of ambition and a sense of quality and excellence about our programming, our exhibitions, our projects, and just make that as accessible as possible. So, you know, great art for the widest possible public. It's as simple as that.
Can I just say how very refreshing it is to have such modesty on this podcast? It's very unusual.
What a great note to end on, though. What a
exactly.
Great note to end on. We'll have it
you.
Carved on your tombstone, Sir John.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Now, maybe have it tattooed.
Yeah. Well, thank you so
brilliant.
Much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
No, thank you both. And good luck with the tombstone. Was the tombstone? With the podcast. There was just I was listening to your, was it Lumi, your sponsor? And it just reminded me of, you know, the when you chuck out a basin after doing the dishes, there's some stuff stuck in the outlet of the sink. We don't really have a word for that in English, but the Dutch have a great word for all those little bits of stuff that gets stuck in the sink. The Dutch call that prut, prut. I thought such a great word.
Such a good word. Yeah, I think we'll tell Lomi that. From prut to plant waste. I think that's very good. Excellent.
Anyway, nice to see you both.
Before we go, we wanted to alert you to the 5th annual Chelsea History Festival. It starts on Tuesday, the 26th of September. It runs until the 1st of October. It's at the National Army Museum, the Chelsea Physics Garden, which also celebrates its 350th anniversary this year, and the Royal Hospital Chelsea. It's going to be a packed out programme of talks, open days, walking tours, concerts and more.
And yes, highlights include former Rolling Stones bassist Bill Wyman talking about his Chelsea during the 60s and 70s. Surprised he can remember any of it. Michael Palin talking about his great uncle who died in the First World War, plus a lot of new young voices like historian and TikTok star Rosie Hart talking about royal fashion.
Once again, many thanks to Lomi for supporting us, and please don't fail to take advantage of this wonderful offer. You get 50 quid off a Lomi of your very own. You go to Lomi's website at uk.lomi.com and use the promo code BREAKOUT at the checkout. Next week, we're talking to Britain's leading female stone sculptor, Emily Young, and Francis Hamill, the landscape and portrait artist, about his new paintings of gardens. Both have exhibitions opening in the West End in October, so don't fail to tune in then.